I want to get started on my first topic. This coming Wednesday, the United States Supreme Court will hear arguments on a case involving the NCAA regarding student-athlete compensation. And this is an issue that may lead to the idea that athletes who are students may eventually have to be paid. Maybe not, maybe. And what does that mean to college athletics? What is this case about? What precedent could it set? And what do we think the Supreme Court is going to do? And here to talk about this interesting case is a sports law professor, Anneli Drew, who's a law professor of practice in sports law, director of the Center of Advancement of Sports at University of Buffalo School of Law. Professor Drew, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me, Karen.
So let's talk about, we're going to have to take a break in a few minutes, but let's set up the case that is going to be before the U.S. Supreme Court. Tell me who the litigants are and what the issue is for the court to decide.
Sure. So the plaintiff in this case is Mr. Alston, who's a former running back from West Virginia. And he received a scholarship back there back in 2009, but the scholarship didn't cover things like groceries, clothing, trips home, and the like. So oftentimes he has reported that he went to bed hungry, and as I'm sure you can imagine, for an 18-year-old kid playing an active sport, that wasn't a particularly good situation.
Right.
So, yeah, so anyhow, he became a plaintiff in a class action lawsuit against the NCAA, challenging a rule that the NCAA has in place, which prevents member schools from providing what's known as incidental benefits, things above and beyond scholarships for tuition, room and board, and the like.
So he's challenging that limitation. And can you just, we talk about antitrust laws, and even among lawyers, it's a confusing area of law. Can you really break it down very simply? The courts obviously don't consider, is it fair to pay athletes? Is it, what do we like? Is it good idea? Is it bad idea? I've had that topic on my show, and it's an interesting debate. But this is a very legal issue, of course, going before the United States Supreme Court. What precisely are the laws that involve this particular decision?
Yeah, so it's a dense topic for sure.
Yeah.
To sort of boil it down into plain language, essentially, there's a federal law that's an antitrust statute that precludes agreements that combine in combination that restrain trade. Okay, in interstate commerce. And what's going on here is because you have the various schools in the NCAA who have consented to these rules that restrict schools from providing students with anything above and beyond scholarships that provide simply for tuition and room and board, that is seen as a restriction upon commerce. If those rules were in place, those students could then negotiate for, presumably, some compensation above and beyond that level. And so that gets us into the whole antitrust analysis.
Okay. So let's take a break now. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about what the arguments on both sides is going to be, and then maybe talk about some of these new laws that are being passed in states that talk about how an athlete is allowed to or not allowed to use his likeness, whether it's a jersey or doing endorsements and those types of things, and what that might mean in conjunction with this lawsuit. We're here talking to Professor Anneli Drew, and you're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. Sports law, and we're talking about a case that's going to the United States Supreme Court this Wednesday on the issue of whether student athletes can have their benefits limited by the NCAA rules. And with us to talk about this interesting issue is Professor Anneli Drew. She's with the University of Buffalo School of Law. Hi, Anneli. Is she back? Is she back? Here she is. Hi. Hi.
Hello.
Okay, so you set up the case, and if you can give our listeners what the arguments are going to be from the athlete's standpoint, and then maybe some of the arguments that the NCAA is going to make on their side of the story.
Sure. So from the athlete's perspective, it's grossly unfair as it currently stands. Now, there was a study done in 2012, I believe, that indicated that over 80% of student athletes for football and men's basketball live below the poverty line, which is an incredible statistic. And certainly so the opportunity to have this incremental amount of money would be essential for many of them. certainly also the optics aren't great. The NCAA is an institution which is governed primarily by white men, and they've been gathering increasing amounts of revenue over the decades from the work product of the historically revenue-producing sports, FBS football and men's basketball, which are increasingly played by young men of color, and many of whom, of course, are from underprivileged backgrounds. So the combination is you know, very, very startling. The social justice implications are concerning at best. And finally, of course, you have to consider the number of student athletes who will eventually go pro and actually be able to realize, you know, some sort of revenue on their playing careers. And that's typically less than 10%. So, you know, the equities would seem to be, you know, substantially in favor of the student athletes on that side. On the other hand, you have the NCAA saying, well, you know what, you know, once you violate those parameters, once you start allowing the professionalism aspect to creep in, the jig is up and the amateur model as we know it is gone. And they also argue that having that sort of investment on campus will create a gap between the student athletes and the rest of the community. And finally, the NCAA makes the allegation that these rules actually protect the student athletes. They protect them from the sort of arguably murky waters of the commercial marketplace, where they are likely to fall prey to devious actors who are seeking to profit from them. Now, that argument is highly suspect, especially in the pandemic world, where we have student athletes right now during March Madness this weekend quarantined in hotels in Texas so that they can generate substantial amounts of money for the NCAA as part of March Madness, while their fellow students are typically learning remotely safely from home.
Interesting. And I've also heard the other argument that these revenue sports really do fund the other non-revenue sports, so that essentially everybody is getting a benefit from the athletes. And maybe without those revenue sports, we wouldn't have swimming and soccer and some of the other sports that maybe aren't making as much money or any money at all.
Yeah, that's definitely a concern. It's certainly true that revenue sports can help fund non-revenue sports, but it's important to remember that relatively few athletic departments actually show a profit. College sports total revenues are typically driven by the Power Five conferences, the big conferences that have some of the most successful collegiate programs. And those programs brought in more than about $7 billion in revenue last year, which is 54% of the total college sports revenue. And to give you some perspective, there are over 2,000 collegiate athletic programs. So you've got a very small percentage of those generating most of the revenue. Still, even in those Power Five conferences, only 25 schools actually showed a net revenue. So, you know, the number of schools that are actually sort of funding the whole shebang for the other less well-known sports is relatively small.
Interesting. So this is not the issue before the U.S. Supreme Court this week is not the issue of whether athletes can be paid. It's kind of a stepping stone maybe to that issue in that you're talking about limiting educational related or school related benefits. First of all, let's talk about, given the makeup of the court, which is leaning maybe a little conservative these days, what do you think is going to happen as far as how are they going to parse it? And what, if you're a guessing person, take out your legal crystal ball, and what do you think they're going to do with this?
That's a great question. Well, there should be two possible outcomes, although I would not put it past the Supreme Court to try to punt and avoid a definitive result. So I'm going to put a third in there as well.
Okay.
The first outcome would be the NCAA loses, and its amateurism eligibility rules, as we know them, are held to be a violation of the antitrust laws, at least insofar as they prevent schools from offering student-athletes compensation that is not tied to tuition, room, and board. If that happens, the historical NCAA amateurism model, as we know it, is blown apart, and we have a whole new frontier in collegiate athletics. If the NCAA wins, then the inroads that were made by a previous decision, the O'Bannon decision, which has to do with the name, image, and likeness rules of the NCAA, are going to be rolled back. And student athletes are once more going to be subject to very strict rules that govern their activities as, quote-unquote, amateurs. I think what's probably going to happen is that the court's going to decide to split the baby, as it will, and try to find some sort of standard which would allow student-athletes to benefit from their performance to a limited extent that falls short of the full extent of free market competition. And the legal justification of that type of approach would be interesting at best.
Yes. Going back to the idea that let's just say that the Supreme Court goes all the way and says that these are violations. All of these types of things are violations of antitrust laws. Is it possible that then we have bidding wars for college athletes that are in the millions and millions of dollars? Do you think that there would still be able to have, they would have caps on what they can pay athletes so that there's some sort of even playing field, so to speak?
Well, that's why we're seeing this rush to in state legislatures to put these NIL bills in place, right?
What an NIL bill is.
Sure, I'm sorry. NIL is shorthand for name, image, and likeness. So California was the first state to institute that, but the effective date of that statute is not until 2023. What's generating the sort of rush to the state houses right now is that Florida passed a bill that it has become law and will become effective on July 1st. So,
and what does that law say? Tell our listeners exactly what that law would do.
That will give student athletes the ability in Florida, the ability to profit from the use of their name, image, and likeness as it connects to their athletic performance, which is something that is currently prohibited by NCAA rules.
So they could go out and they could endorse a car dealership, or they could sell jerseys with their number on it, and that might be infringing on the NCAA.
Yeah, there be some issues there with respect to the ability to use the
school's
logo. Right, exactly. And to answer your other question in terms of like salary caps, that can't happen at the NCAA level because salary caps are just another form of a restriction that would violate the antitrust laws. The reason we see those in professional sports is because they are subject to an antitrust exemption because they're collectively bargained, and there are no unions in the NCAA right now.
Okay, an interesting issue. I know Illinois passed, I believe in the House, a bill like it was similar to the one in Florida that said that schools cannot put restrictions on the athletes' use of their name and image and likeness. And it looks like our governor wants to sign it, and it's just a matter of time before the Senate passes it and we have a law. Well, what happens if Illinois or Wisconsin or Florida has a law that says you can't restrict, but then the NCAA rules say, yes, we will restrict. So is this going to result in schools kind of like opting out of the NCAA?
Well, there's a question. And in fact, when California passed that first NIL bill, the NCAA reacted very strongly. And there was some suggestion that the Pac-12 and the West Coast might actually break away from the NCAA. So is that possible? Certainly there's the potential for that. I suspect what really is going to happen is there'll be a tremendous amount of pressure for a federal bill that will address this matter. And it's interesting to note, by the way, that the NCAA considered adjusting its rules in January and then decided to forego doing so. I suspect, and many others do as well, because they're awaiting the outcome of the Alston case to see what happens.
Very, very interesting. So the Supreme Court will hear arguments, and usually it'll be a few months before we get a decision. And I believe that one of the lawyers who's arguing in favor of the athletes is a Winston & Strawn, which is a big firm here in Chicago, a lawyer with that firm. So I sent him a little note to wish him well, and hopefully it'll be an interesting argument. If people are interested in listening to the Supreme Court arguments, they stream, and you can actually listen to them on a podcast version of it. It's not always the most interesting thing in the world, but if you're interested in the topic, it's something you should do, and you just log into the Supreme Court website, and they make it very accessible for you. So you, Professor Drew, you are a law professor, and you have 7 children, and which is almost enough for a baseball team, but not more than a basketball team. So that's amazing. I mean, you must be very busy.
I am. My youngest is now 15, so we're sort of aging out, as it were. But we played hockey, so we had plenty for a hockey team.
Oh my goodness! I can't even imagine what your schedule on your bulletin board looks like in your kitchen. but thank you so much for joining us, and please join us again. I'm sure these issues are going to continue, and I think it's going to be an interesting road to see where college athletes are going to go, and in the next 10 years in particular. Thank you so much, Professor Drew.
Thank you very much, Karen. Have a great day.
Okay, you too.